Ready? Hello, today I'm speaking with Kat Aaron of the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project. Kat, could you explain some of the goals of the project?
Sure. The Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project, also known as NEDAP, is a resource center for community groups in New York City that are organizing for financial justice. And we provide legal support, technical support, research, computer mapping services, and basically we respond to the needs articulated by different organizations and try to help them with their campaigns.
Can you give some examples of the projects that various organizations work on who use your services?
Sure. We do a fairly broad range of projects. I mean, we do anything from just answering people's questions that come up during the course of a campaign to organizing and collaborating on campaigns with groups throughout the city. We recently helped members of the Service Employees Industrial Union in a campaign that they were organizing for a building that was trying to unionize, and the workers were out on strike, and they just called and asked if we knew anything about the owner because he owned a bank. So we did some research for them about the bank, and they contacted the bank and contacted the regulators and just sort of raised enough fuss that their campaign ended successfully. You know, so we'll just sort of do one-off research for people on that level, helping them find out who owns a certain building or what lender made a loan that is allowing someone to buy a new building and they're going to raise the rents, things like that. To also doing sort of longer-term projects, we did one, a research project for the Lower East Side People's Federal Credit Union, documenting what banks were operating in the Lower East Side here in Manhattan, and also looking at what we call fringe banking services exist in the community, which are pawn shops, check cashers, the sort of non-mainstream financial services that low-income communities are often forced to use because the mainstream banks don't serve poor communities. And that is related in a way to another project that we at NEDAP worked on, which was helping residents in Red Hook in Brooklyn organize to get a bank branch in their community. They had no bank services at all anywhere in their neighborhood, and it was 2 bus rides away to the closest bank. And so we worked with neighborhood residents to figure out what they wanted in terms of banking services, and then worked with them collecting signatures and contacting the presidents of various banks that serve New York City, and launched a 2-year campaign organizing, doing sort of demographic research, and that culminated in the opening of a branch of the Independence Bank in Red Hook, the first bank branch they had in decades in that area.
How do these fringe banking services affect the community?
Fringe banking is a term that we use for things like pawn shops or check cashers or payday lenders. They are higher cost services than those offered by mainstream banks. I mean, check cashers are a replacement for having a checking account, and pawn shops replace one's ability to get a loan from a mainstream lender, but you wind up paying far higher interest rates, and to pay a fee every time you need to cash a check, you wind up spending much more money than you would if you just had a checking account. Payday lenders fulfill the same purpose as check cashers. With a payday lender, basically you post-date a check to them, and they give you the money up front, and then when you get your paycheck, you bring it to them, and they get the amount that they've lent you plus a fee for the privilege of lending you the money in advance. But it's such a high fee that if you calculated it as an annual interest rate, it's, you know, something like 300% to 500% a year interest rate, depending on the fee that they charge you. So, you know, I mean, that's as if I had a loan for $100, and then at the end of the year I had to pay back $3,000. I mean, it's just outrageous.
Are there other solutions to this problem? Are there any groups that educate people to avoid these problems?
Well, I mean, it's not in a way a question of educating people. People know that these services are expensive, but if you have no banks in your community, you have no alternative but to turn to a pawn shop or a check casher for your banking needs. I mean, it's partly a question of consumer education, but I'd say in large part it's a question of the mainstream banks not serving low-income communities and communities of color, and also in the relatively rare instances when mainstream banks do have a presence in low-income neighborhoods, the branches aren't welcoming to the community. The ads feature all white families. They have tellers that are unpleasant to people that come in to use. I mean, that's not overall, but you know, it's not the same comfortable environment as it is at the check casher that's run by the guy that's lived on your block for 50 years. And often the banks won't have tellers that speak the language of the community that they're serving. I mean, I think partly people go where it's familiar, but even in the communities where there are mainstream banks, I don't think that those mainstream banks make a huge amount of effort to really serve the neighborhood.
How does predatory lending work, and what effect does it have on low-income affordable housing?
Oh God, it's a big question. Oh, I did want to say one thing, though, about alternatives to the fringe banking services. In a lot of communities, people have opened community development credit unions, and those are institutions whose mission is to serve communities that have been sort of neglected by the mainstream lenders. There's one here in the Lower East Side. There's one in Bushwick in Brooklyn. There's one in the South Bronx. And their mission is not to profit from the community, but to serve the community and meet the real banking needs by providing consumer education classes and classes on how to repair your credit and low-cost or no-cost checking accounts and low-interest, small-volume loans that the kind of services that the mainstream banks don't offer. And that's a really important and growing movement in the banking sector and in community banking. And there are community development credit unions all over the country. So
some people are losing their homes because they fail on their mortgage. How is that working?
In terms of predatory lending?
Yeah.
Well, a predatory loan, it's a little bit more complicated than failing on your mortgage. I guess I'll run down the sort of basic scenario. Predatory lending is a sort of illicit sector within the subprime lending market. Subprime lending is loans made to people with less than prime credit, subprime credit. So people with damaged credit history. And there is obviously a need for legitimate subprime lending. People with damaged credit need loans, and there needs to be a way that those people can get loans. But predatory lending is not legitimate subprime lending. It's loans that exploit people and take advantage of their difficulties in getting credit by basically tricking them into loans that are packed with incredibly exorbitant fees and are very costly and have high interest rates and often wind up costing people their homes. The sort of archetypal scenario is a older woman who lives in her house. She's lived there for a long time and is living on a fixed income, either a pension or Social Security, and owns her home almost free and clear, or does own it free and clear. But these people are often called cash poor but equity rich. They're rich in the equity in their home but have very little cash. And mortgage brokers will go door to door in neighborhoods or solicit via phone or via the mail. And, you know, someone will knock on the door and say, oh, I notice your roof is having problems. Maybe you need some extra money for repairs, or maybe you have a problem with maybe you've been in the hospital and you need some extra cash. You need some money. And, you know, people often these are low-income communities where this is taking place by and large, and people do need extra cash, and so they enter, the mortgage broker presents them with these loan papers, and they say, oh, it'll solve all your problems, low monthly rate, and people often don't quite understand what it is that they're getting into. The documents are hard to understand, they're often pretty unintelligible, or they have sort of blank spaces that get filled in at the closings. A common thing that we see is what's called bait and switch. People will be shown one set of terms on the loan documents, and when they go to the closing, the numbers on the papers will be different from what they had previously reviewed. So they'll go and they'll sign these loan documents, not understanding that the loan has all these fees that are paid to the broker. We often see sort of broker's fees, which are basically nothing more than kickbacks to the broker, of, you know, 7% of the loan amount, or thousands and thousands of dollars. And these loans will have interest rates that are, you know, 15%, 16%, 17%, and they'll have, people will often be sold credit life insurance, which is supposedly to protect you in the event, protect your heirs in the event that you die before you manage to repay the loan. But people don't understand that this is a feature of the loan, and they don't understand that they're not obligated to take it. So they'll be spending all this money that they don't know they're spending, and then they find themselves quickly unable to pay the loan because the loan payments each month are so high. I mean, we'll see cases where people will have monthly loan payments higher than their monthly income, and which, I mean, it's just mind-blowing. So they quickly find themselves in a position where they're unable to repay it. Oh, another thing that we see a lot in these loans is at the end of the loan, there'll be what's called a balloon payment. So you'll be making $100 payments, for example, each month. And then at the end of, you know, 10 years, your last payment will be $5,000, which of course you're not able to pay, but your loan broker will come, your mortgage broker will come back and say, oh, you know, we can refinance the loan. So people get what we call flipped. They'll get a loan and then be induced into taking out another loan and maybe another loan. And at each refinancing of the loan, there'll be more fees and more sort of padded charges that people wind up spending thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars and getting very little in exchange. And often people are unable to make the payments and default on their loan and go into foreclosure and lose their house. And we see it all the time, all over the country.
Could you explain some of the negative consequences of the welfare reform legislation which took place in 96?
Okay. Well, I'd say the negative consequences of the Welfare Reform Act are far too many to enumerate right now, but one of them that I work on a lot is, in 96, Congress passed what was called the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Act, more commonly known as the Welfare Reform Act, and one of the things that required, or set forth, I don't know what the term is, but people had to receive their food stamps via electronic distribution. And so many states decided to put their state-issued benefits and cash benefits on the electronic distribution system as well. And they contracted in New York State and in almost every other state, I think actually every other state, the states contracted with Citibank to distribute the public assistance. And so now, instead of getting paper checks and paper food stamps each month, public assistance recipients have a card that is supposed to function in the same way as an ATM card, and you go to a cash machine and withdraw your benefits, and you can use it at a checkout to pay for things with your food stamps or with your cash. And Citibank and Lockheed Martin teamed up to provide these benefits electronically, and the system is abysmal. It's people are supposed to be able to have 4 free transactions on their cards each month, but the transactions are only free at certain cash machines, and those cash machines are few and far between. And actually, Citibank in New York City was recently was the subject of an investigation by the Civil Rights Department of the Attorney General's Office and the State Comptroller, and those investigations found that 92% of the machines that were supposed to provide free access were not doing so. So there's basically has been no places that people can access their welfare benefits for free, which means that people are paying $1.50, $2, even as high as $2.50 each time they want to withdraw their cash. And if you're only getting $600-odd a month for a family of 4, that's the most you can get in a month in New York State. And, I mean, that's a huge amount of money. Even for someone who's making $30,000 a year, $2 is a high ATM fee. But if you're getting $600 a month, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's as if you, someone making $30,000 a year, were paying, you know, $50 a month in ATM fees to make 4 transactions. So, I mean, in a way, it's not Citibank's responsibility to not rip people off. I mean, it's the contract that they entered into with the state. And ultimately, the responsibility lies with the state to negotiate a good contract. But I think this is a really, the program, the Electronic Benefits Transfer Program, as it's called, I think is a really telling example of the dangers of privatization of public function. Because the state has a responsibility to its citizens to ensure that they have the money that they need to live and to eat. And of course, I don't think that they do so in any sort of meaningful way now. And I think the welfare problem is incredibly flawed. There's a lot of people that it doesn't serve at all. But, I mean, now with Citibank, there's no recourse for the public assistance recipient because they're a private corporation and they fulfill their contractual obligations, and that's the end of the story. With the state, there are people that you elect, and they appoint people, and you have a degree, albeit a small degree, of control over that process. But if all the public functions are contracted out to a profit-making entity, then the obligations of that company aren't to the citizen. The obligations of that company are to its shareholders. And I think that is a lesson that people need to be mindful of, that you can't, a corporation is never going to put the needs of the public that it's serving before the needs of its shareholders. And if you expect corporations to provide services as a state will provide, you're going to run into trouble. And I think the Electronic Benefits Transfer Program is a really good example of that.
Can you give an example of an economic and social justice project happening in New York City?
There are people organizing what's being called the Anti-Displacement Task Force, and it's sort of a coalition of people working in all different arenas on, basically it's just a group of people that are really concerned about the gentrification and displacement that we've been seeing in New York City in the last several years, and it's a coalition of concerned folk from all different areas of work who have come together to try to address the problem. And there's a group working to organize an anti-displacement tax credit, which is sort of in the planning stages, but the proposal would be to have a tax credit for landlords that voluntarily kept their rents low. And they would get a tax. So for example, say the market rent for a 1-bedroom apartment is $1,000, but they were renting it to someone who'd been there for a long time, and that person was paying $500. So rather than displacing the tenant, they could get a tax credit for the difference between the rent that they're charging and the rent that they could be getting. The idea would be that that would be an incentive. I mean, it wouldn't be the full amount, but it would be an incentive to landlords to not evict people from the communities that they've lived in for so long. And another project that I think is really exciting that people, one of the groups in the coalition has been working on is a displacement-free zone. And this group, the Fifth Avenue Committee in Brooklyn, works in Park Slope, which is a community in South Park Slope that used to be fairly low-income and now is getting incredibly wealthy. And they took, I believe, a 5-square-block radius and called it a displacement-free zone, and they've been providing legal services and holding big demonstrations and doing big organizing projects and education projects for the tenants of those living in those blocks, and they've been really successful in averting evictions of low-income, low-rent tenants in that area, and I think it's a really important model of a community just coming together and saying, you know, no, we're not going to have this, and we're going to shame the landlords and embarrass them and go. I mean, they've been doing stuff like going to the churches and homes and schools where the landlords live and handing out posters saying, you know, this landlord is evicting an 80-year-old woman, blah, 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 and using sort of tactics that are familiar in the union organizing movement, and I think it's really inspiring and hopeful to see community organizers really taking on gentrification at such a direct one-on-one level.